From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, Mayor Cavalier Johnson joins us to reflect on hosting the RNC and shares how he's going to be involved in this week's Democratic National Convention. Then we'll learn about the new Madeline Island Museum exhibit called Passages.
The creation of the apostles, our migration to get here, they're almost spiritual stories in a way. In fact, they are spiritual stories, and they really give an awesome foundation and context to the Ojibwe place-based connectivity here.
Then some of us have noticed lots of dragonflies along Lake Michigan's shoreline. We'll learn why.
There's probably a trickle of the migratory guys going by, and as I say, the feeding swarm is usually pretty easy to tell because they're kind of staying in the same area and just flying around slowly in figure eights looking for food.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today, we'll learn about the journey of migration to Madeline Island that's been shared through centuries of Ojibwe storytelling. Plus, we'll learn why you've probably noticed a ton of dragonflies lately. We'll start with this. It's been over a month since the Republican National Convention took over downtown Milwaukee. Mayor Cavalier Johnson was a key player in bringing the four-day convention to the city. He said it would have positive economic benefits and put Milwaukee in a national spotlight. But was it all worth it? Columbus, Ohio police officers who were in town for the RNC shot and killed a Milwaukee man who was armed with two knives about a mile away from the convention. And despite high expectations, business was a boom for some and a bust for others. Lake Effect's Ex-Grit Nunez sat down with Mayor Johnson to reflect on hosting the RNC and share how he'll be involved in this week's Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
So you'll be in Chicago attending the DNC as a delegate, but I first want to reflect on the RNC that Milwaukee hosted a few weeks ago. Looking back on everything that happened, how do you feel the RNC went?
I feel that the RNC went very, very well for Milwaukee. My desire in pitching Milwaukee for the RNC, working with our partners that visit Milwaukee, the county executive, private businesses to bring the RNC here to Milwaukee was all about elevating the city, was about further putting Milwaukee on the map and shining a brighter light on the city. I don't want for Milwaukee to continue to be the best kept secret around. Like, I want people to discover the city. And by all accounts from people who came here, many folks who never even came to not just Milwaukee, but the state of Wisconsin, period, but had a remarkable time here during that week and have said that they are looking to come back and said that, for many of them, whether it was their first convention or their 10th convention, and I ran into some people who attended that many, they said that this was the best experience ever. I ran into somebody just on Thursday last week, and they told me that the convention in Milwaukee was their 8th. And it was the very best convention that they'd ever gone to. So we elevated the city. Images of Milwaukee were beamed into living rooms and C-suites all around the country and around the world. And that's a good thing for Milwaukee.
So with the RNC coming to town, a lot of people were concerned about safety. On the second day of the RNC, on July 16th, officers from Columbus, Ohio, shot and killed Samuel Sharp Jr. near 17th and Valit. A month later, it's been a month. What is your response to that shooting? Has your opinion on it changed since you first found out about it?
No, my opinion hasn't changed on the shooting. I mean, first of all, you never want something like that to happen, especially if you're hosting a large-scale event where the eyes of the country and the eyes of the world are fixated on your city. So I certainly didn't want that. I know that, folks in the neighborhood, Mr. Sharp's family wouldn't have wanted that either. And so you always have condolences when somebody loses their life. But at the same time, too, when I've talked to officers who are here, and even local officers, too, when there's an individual who is disobeying officer commands to drop weapons, and, Mr. Sharp, unfortunately, was wielding not one knife, but two knives, and was thrusting towards an unarmed man in a threatening manner, any officer would have engaged the way that that they did in order to protect and preserve the life of, in this case, the unarmed individual. So I'm saddened by Mr. Sharpe's death. But when the police body cam footage was released and you saw, again, the multiple commands by officers to drop the weapons and that wasn't obeyed, and then there was a thrusting towards, you know, the unarmed gentleman. From what I understand from folks that review these things, that it was a clean shot and justified as well.
Well, before the RNC, it was said that out-of-state officers would be helping within the security perimeter, so Milwaukee police would still be the ones serving their community. But why were out-of-state officers patrolling Milwaukee neighborhoods and not the security perimeter?
Sure. So the outside officers, the Columbus officers in this case, the day before, there was a protest in that area. And so they, at that time, I believe, were with Milwaukee police officers. They were in that area that day simply debriefing, simply meeting. So they were not there in a patrolling, front-facing sort of manner. It just so happened to be that officers heard this commotion that was going on. One of the officers then noticed that there were weapons, you know, that were involved. And being a law enforcement officer and looking to preserve life, engaged and tried to get those weapons to be dropped so that nobody would have been injured or worse in that situation. And that's where what I just described happened, where the escalation of things happened. So it was not that they were there and without Milwaukee police in a patrolling, front-facing sort of role. They were simply there debriefing in reflection of the protest that happened the other day, perhaps preparing for any other protest that might come that day or other days during the convention, and then just happened to witness and then intervened in the situation.
Local leaders and organizers were concerned about the city hosting the RNC for reasons like this, you know, bringing in non-local law enforcement to the city. Have you spoken to organizers about these concerns or addressed them in any way?
Well, look, again, as I mentioned, when I've had conversations with, you know, folks in law enforcement, whether they were outside officers, including local officers, including Milwaukee police officers, I mean, they have said that they all would have engaged in the exact same way to preserve life. So, I mean, can I understand, you know, what the concerns are from, you know, some of those folks? Yeah, I can. But when I talk to local officers from the Milwaukee Police Department, the ones who, you know, they would have preferred to be there in a patrolling front-facing way, which, I mean, there just didn't happen to be a local police officer at that space at that time. But if there was, you very likely would have seen the very same outcome. And because there was no local officer right there, the unarmed man likely would have suffered severe injury or possibly even death, which I think also would have been unacceptable to, you know, those folks who are complaining or have issue, rather, about Mr. Sharpe and complaining about the presence of the outside officers who were on scene.
So do you think if Milwaukee does host a large-scale event like this again in the future, would public safety be handled differently?
Well, I mean, if you host a large-scale political convention like that, yes, I mean, there's always space that you can learn from. I mean, I think there's space that we have learned from with the RNC. I think that other large-scale gatherings, and we've had them since the RNC has been over, mind you, right? Harley-Davidson was here for their annual event. Northwestern Mutual was here for their annual event. These are, you know, tens of thousands of people who have descended upon Milwaukee. And even before the RNC, I mean, the Bastille Days that's happened. You know, the other large-scale festivals, whether it's Summerfest or whether it's a state fair for the portion that is certainly in the city of Milwaukee. So we've had other large-scale events since. And I think that law enforcement in all those cases does a really, really good job. But the other thing you got to consider here too, again, is yes, these were, you know, outside officers. If they were there and they had done nothing, and this, you know, other gentleman, the unarmed gentleman, was killed, I would just imagine what the criticism of those officers would have been then, that they did not intervene, you know? So yes, there's always space that you can learn from when an incident like this happens. When we host other large-scale events, and I intend to host other large-scale events in this city to further put a spotlight on Milwaukee and shine the bright light on this wonderful city that we have, it's unlikely that you'll see that sort of security footprint, that sort of security apparatus, because we wouldn't be hosting somebody who, a principal at a convention like that, that if he, in this case, were to be successful in his election, would be the president of the United States of America, right? The most powerful person on the face of planet Earth. So it's unlikely that you'd see that with hosting, I don't know, I'm just going to, you know, pull something out of the air, an NBA draft, or, you know, an IndyCar, or a Major League Baseball All-Star game, or what have you.
So I just want to shift gears a little bit. In the months leading up to the convention, there was an expectation that there would be a big boost for businesses downtown. But when we spoke to some businesses in and around the perimeter, that didn't seem to be the case for them. Did the RNC have the economic impact you expected?
Well, that's a great question, too. So, again, I think there's space for us to learn. Like, I'll be the first one to tell you that I think there's opportunities to learn. And this was our first time, you know, hosting something like this. I mean, this was the biggest hosting job that the city has ever done, And as I said before, if the principal at the convention were to be successful in his political efforts, would become president of the United States, most powerful person on earth. This is the biggest thing that we've ever done. And it's the first time we've ever had a security apparatus, a security footprint, the likes that we saw during the Republican National Convention. So, yeah, I think there's opportunities for us to learn. I know that a number of the businesses near the convention site didn't fare as well as they thought that they might or wanted to. And quite frankly, I mean, I wanted them to do better, too. However, there were a number of local businesses, Milwaukee businesses, Wisconsin businesses that were at convention fests right inside the security perimeter that did very, very well. I mean, there were businesses on MLK Drive that did very, very well as well. There were other businesses that did, you know, pretty well, too. We don't have all the numbers because those numbers are being crunched by, you know, our visitors and Convention Bureau, Visit Milwaukee, and others. But when you look at the hotel spend from that week in 2023 versus the week of the RNC in 2024, in 2023, hotel spend that week was $5 million. And hotel spend during the week of 2024 during the RNC was $19 million. So there's some pretty significant expenditure there. We'll see how it shakes out with the rest of the economy. I'm hoping that, you know, the numbers are really good. But yeah, there's opportunities for us to learn from anything that we do.
Yeah, and I know you said the numbers are still being crunched and stuff. But I think that is a question on, like, a lot of people's minds is, do you kind of have a range of how much the city made, like?
I mean, quite honestly, I don't have that. I mean, if I did, I'd tell you. Just like I told you, the hotel numbers, for whatever reason, and these are, you know, beyond me, we don't, you know, keep track of that stuff at the city of Milwaukee. There are others that we would work with to find that information. But from what I understand, while those other numbers are being worked on and being crunched, the hotel numbers, I think, get reported on a pretty regular basis anyway. So that's why we have those numbers already. $5 million during that week in 2023, $19 million in 2024 during the Republican National Convention. And those are hotels strictly within the city of Milwaukee. And I think you saw some additional growth as well when you compare those 2 weeks for hotels within Milwaukee County as well.
So at the end of the day, do you feel it was worth it to host the RNC in Milwaukee?
I mean, So my goal here is to have the opportunity to put Milwaukee, you know, further up on the list. I want Milwaukee to be a city that's recognized as one of these great emerging middle tier and growing American cities. You can't do that unless people pay attention to you. The RNC certainly got a lot of people across the country and around the world talking about Milwaukee, putting boots on the ground in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin, quite frankly, for the very first time. There were images of this city being beamed again into living rooms and into C-suites all across the country and all across the world. I had the opportunity to speak to a lot of press, local press, Wisconsin press, national press, international press that all were here in Milwaukee. I think that this was a very good thing in shining a brighter light on Milwaukee because we have to compete. We have to compete for business investment. We have to compete for talent. We have to make our case, like if we want for our city to grow and be a prosperous place. I mean, if you think about what's happening in our region in the Midwest, I mean, Minneapolis continues to rise. Detroit is having just this amazing comeback. Cleveland is doing all the stuff that it's doing. Indianapolis is rising. I mean, Chicago is basically the capital of the Midwest. Like, I want Milwaukee to rise, too. I don't want Milwaukee to be on the back end of that and fall. And so we have to be able to compete with these places. And I think the RNC put us in a strong position to continue to compete for these other large-scale events to attract that talent and attract good jobs and create, by virtue of these large events coming here, a virtuous economic cycle for the people who live, work, and own businesses in Milwaukee.
Understood. You're listening to Lake Effect. I'm Excret Nunez, speaking with Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson about hosting the RNC and attending the DNC. So moving on to talk about the DNC, You are one of 95 Wisconsin delegates attending the convention in Chicago.
Yes.
How did you become a delegate and why did you want to do it?
Well, I don't think that I did anything special to become a delegate other than be elected mayor of the city of Milwaukee. I think just by dint of my position being mayor of a big city in America and a Democrat, you get the opportunity to go and attend the convention. But be that as it may, whether I was mayor or not, I still would want to attend the Democratic National Convention. I always have wanted to. This will be my very first convention that I've had the opportunity to attend, and a really historical one at that, right? I mean, just think about the historic candidacy that Kamala Harris has, along with Governor Walz, only the second woman ever to win the nomination of a major American political party, the first, of course, being Secretary Hillary Clinton, who I proudly supported in 2016, the first Black woman to have the opportunity to not just clinch a nomination, but I think will go on to be the 47th president of the United States. That's really remarkable. And I'll do all the things that delegates do, but chief among them is making sure that we offer the Wisconsin delegation and the Democratic National Convention's support for Kamala Harris to continue on as our nominee for president leading up to the election on November 5th.
I was going to say the prominent role of delegates is voting for the party's presidential candidate, but that's already happened. Earlier this month, there was the virtual roll call. So what do you do now? What part do you play in the DNC?
Yeah, I mean, that was official. So what we'll do will be symbolic, but I still think that it's important to show the unity that's within our party, to show the unity in the Democratic Party for Vice President Kamala Harris, for Governor Walz, as they proceed to go on beyond the convention and go into the election season, and ultimately, I believe, win the election as well. And I think it's important still to have that stage to show the contrast between what Democrats believe and what Democrats want to accomplish in the United States versus what Republicans want to accomplish in the United States. I mean, I know the convention was here in Milwaukee, but I'm excited about supporting the person who walks across the stage in Chicago, not the one who walked across the stage here in Milwaukee, because Democrats understand the power and the importance of diversity in this country. They understand that when we make investments in people, that's how we get the best out of this country. We want people to be productive, contributing members to society. And by making smart and early investments in folks, that's how you get there. Where Republicans have been focused on chaos and division, you know, for nearly 10 years that Donald Trump has been at the top of that party. So you'll see that contrast being laid out. Democrats have a big tent welcoming for every person in America, regardless of who you are, where you live, what you look like, who you love. And Republicans are, you know, trying to create division, you know, between Americans. And that's not the path that Americans want to go down. Americans want to be unified. They want joy back, right? They want unity back, not chaos and division like we see from the Republicans.
So at past conventions, delegates have voted on resolutions and platform initiatives. What initiatives are you advocating for at the DNC?
Yeah, you know, us at the Democratic National Convention and, you know, things we want to see in Milwaukee, like we want folks to have access to good paying, family supporting jobs, right? Milwaukee, once upon a time, was, you know, known as the machine shop of the world, right? Where we, you know, made things. We still make a lot of things here, but I think there's a tremendous opportunity for us to make more things as, you know, we transform our economy into an economy where folks can have one good job and usually a good union job in order to pay their bills. Because when folks have access to good jobs, that's not good just for them, or good careers, rather. Not even just jobs, but good careers. That's good not just for them. It's good for their family, right? It's good for their kids. It presents them with an opportunity to purchase their own homes and stay in their homes so they're not transient and the neighborhoods are not porous. And when you get a critical mass of that happening and folks are not transient and the neighborhoods aren't porous, that's how you start to tighten up the fabric of the neighborhoods, right? And people start looking out for each other and the relationships become familial. And when that happens, that's when neighborhoods gel, they become cohesive, and that's how you get to the greater public safety that all of us want to see. That's what Democrats understand. And that's one of many things that I think Democrats will be rallying around in their resolution positions at the convention.
Well, is there anything in particular that you're looking forward to doing at the convention?
I'm looking forward to hearing some of the speakers at the convention. Of course, on the final night, we'll hear from the vice president as she takes the Democratic nomination to go on to be president, and Governor Walz of Minnesota to take the nomination to be the vice president of the United States. But we've got a lot of great, you know, heavy hitters, you know, on deck in the Democratic Party who have done so much, not just for the party, but for our country. You know, folks like former President Barack Obama, folks like former President Bill Clinton, folks like former Secretary of State and the 2016 Democratic nominee for president, Secretary Hillary Clinton, folks like our current president, who has done just a phenomenal, phenomenal job, just one of the most inspiring people that I've ever had the chance to meet. And on more than one occasion, President Joe Biden, who is the consummate statesman and patriot, you know. So I'm excited about having the opportunity to hear from all of these folks and more. As we get the convention kicked off this week.
Well, before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to add that I didn't ask?
Nope, I think you got it.
Well, Mayor Johnson, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, happy to do it.
That was Like Effects expert Nunez speaking with Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson. Some members of the WUWM team have noticed swarms of dragonflies along the Lake Michigan shoreline in recent weeks. Later in the show, WUWM's Susan Benz investigates to find out more about why that's happening. But first, we're heading up to Madeline Island to learn about a new exhibit all about the area's Ojibwe history. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Apostle Islands are considered the jewels of Lake Superior, and Madeline Island, the largest of the Apostle Islands, has always been a hub. It's served as a bountiful supply for food and other natural resources, a waterborne highway, and the epicenter of the Ojibwe worldview. The Ojibwe and other tribes made their homes on Madeline Island for hundreds of years before European contact, and their journey of migration to the island has been shared through centuries of storytelling. A new exhibit called Passages at the Madeline Island Museum shares the story of the Ojibwe's journey to this prophesied island as told through their ancestors' eyes. Museum site director Mike Wiggins Jr. joins me now to share more about it, starting with how the Passages concept grew into the current exhibit.
Looking at the island as a place of epic journeys, it really gave us an opportunity to look at the historical role that the island played in the Shawamigan Bay region. It allowed us to look at the archipelago and the watershed connectivity. Right just a few miles south of Madeline Island is the only wild rice beds on Lake Superior in the Kakag and Bad River sloughs. Those wetlands comprise 47% of the wetlands of Lake Superior, which is really something that kind of staggers the mind a little bit. And then you have the broader archipelago of the Apostles with 40,000 plus acres of protected highlands. Madeline Island sits in the center of all of that. And when we talked about the early Ojibwe history, it really became clear that we have had a great opportunity to light up the island, to light up the region in terms of the habitat and the diversity of habitat that comes together, and then really focusing in on how the early Ojibwe arrival into this area played into this wonderful kind of power place of life.
As you mentioned, the exhibit tells a story of the Ojibwe's 500-year journey to this prophesied island as told through their ancestors' eyes. So to start, can you share some highlights of the stories that you've heard yourself that have been passed on for generations about Madeline Island and the area around it and the journey to it?
Yeah, we talk about in the Passages exhibit, one of our story pods deals with and shares the legend of the Migas. And we have an old that old story told by an elder from Red Cliff, and that's available. And the legend of the Migas is the journey of our people's arrival from the Atlantic Ocean, looking for the place where food grows on the water. There's the great Migas that kept reappearing to the people over the centuries. And we have a couple of little breadcrumbs in there for understanding and remembering. We talk about William Warren and his grandfather. He says in the book, History of the Ojibwe, back in the mid-1800s, William Warren, the author's grandfather, says the Migas, that's the Madewan religion. And it's just one expansion from an interpretive kind of standpoint. He's referring to the Migas as a little white cowrie shell, rounded on one end and kind of got an opening on the other side. But that little white cowrie shell is part of this legend of this great Migas reappearing. Well, when that old man says to his grandson, the Migas is a Madewan religion, he's probably referring to that big long shell of a lodge that would accompany those ceremonies every time that big rounded lodge appeared over the people. They were strong and they would gather themselves up and then things would happen along the lines of that migration. And so there's other facets in our story pod, but I'll just share that for an example of how we interpret the legend of the Migas and maybe bring that to life a little bit. Yeah, and then we have Scooter Charette from the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa talking about the creation of the Apostle Islands, and he's talking about Winnebujou, this early creation character, and how he went about creating the islands, and that story is narrated, and we have some community guide panels with some local knowledge keepers that expand on that. And the creation of the Apostles, our migration to get here, they're almost spiritual stories in a way. And in fact, they are spiritual stories, and they really give an awesome foundation and context to the Ojibwe place-based connectivity here in this area.
So speaking of the area and its importance, the Madeline Island Museum also celebrates the many cultures who have called Madeline Island and the Apostle Island areas home, starting with Ojibwe, French, English, American. So for people who are unfamiliar with the area or perhaps have never been up to Madeline Island before, You touched upon this a tiny bit, but can you expand upon the resources or characteristics that make this area a hub for so many people and cultures over the years?
Well, Madeline Island and the Apostles, it's rooted in habitat, and it's rooted in the protected Lake Superior shorelines and bays. It's protected waterways of the Bedford watershed that really essentially lend a Lake Superior life, but give enough shelter and enough habitat in order to live and stay on the Big Lake. You know, the exposed rocky cliff shorelines of northern Minnesota are a little rougher goal in terms of being on the water, interacting with the water, the Big Lake being the boss, as they say. So Madeline Island, with the island archipelago and the 47% of the wetlands, you had wild rice there in the fall time, migratory flyways, there's incredible fur bearer habitat there. You have essentially the epicenter of the Lake Superior fishery right in that area. And so as people traversed the south shore of Lake Superior from Sault Ste. Marie and onto out west, the island was essentially an old-time hub, basically a trade center that was on a North American continental kind of scale. And there's stories of old footpaths going all the way down to Cahokia. And there's just such a rich, vibrant history that kind of populates the island lore from early indigenous kind of times all the way through the fur trade era, where Madeline Island became a fur trade mecca also.
So knowing the history and importance of Madeline Island in the area, and also knowing the Ojibwe stories, can you share what the beginning of this curation process was like for you? What kind of challenges did you come across? Or I'm sure you wanted to deep dive into so many things, but probably had to learn how to condense and prioritize. So yeah, if you just want to share a bit about what this experience has been like for you, being so connected to the exhibit that you're showing.
Yeah, wanted to be able to try to give the general public a bit of an understanding that of how powerfully connected to the Big Lake the early Ojibwe were. That's where the watercraft and those types of things that are on collections display came into play. But also wanted to be really respectful to the history and basically make sure that it was an exhibit that would speak to some of my elders within like the tribal nations, but that would also speak to visitors from Texas and in Iowa and Illinois, along with our local Shawmigan Bay folks. A huge challenge to put together storylines that speak to that kind of diverse kind of group of folks. But in that was carrying just the sensitivity and a sense of deep respect and reverence for the things that we wanted to share. So conceptually, my teammates within Wisconsin Historical Society were so instrumental. A lot of them had wonderful and amazing experience and knowledge and ideas on how to convey some of the stories. The other factor that really came into play as we put the exhibit together, looking at storylines, was the collections themselves. There were lots of things that helped us in terms of photographs and information. And then reaching out to local community, that we call them community guide panels. We have pictures of some of our local knowledge keepers and elders that are giving some of their thoughts on quotes, just to help light up and bring a little more context and really familiarity in real life kind of personality to our exhibit, I guess you'd say. And so those community guide panels and those elders that were gracious with their time and their quotes and their permission to be in the exhibit were awesome. That ended up kind of falling into the variety of artists that also contributed. There's photographers and painters, and were instrumental in helping us light up the stories.
In addition to the visual art in this exhibit, one of the centerpieces you have is an ancient dugout canoe. Can you tell me a bit about it?
The ancient dugout that we center in that exhibit was just an amazing kind of journey. It had sat in our old fur trade area of the museum for 70 years on a wall, kind of turned on its side for display so you could kind of look into the bottom of it as you stood on a floor. Looking up at the wall, but we took it off the wall and we turned it right side up. And it was a really magical moment seeing that canoe, that ancient dugout kind of come to life. when we brought it up into the center of the exhibit, it just really was a game changer in terms of the presence of that 600 plus year old ancient dugout that was found on Madeline Island. And so there's some really tangible connectivity to the past. It was found by a gentleman named Robert Coffin, and his family is still a vital part of the island. His family is a vital part of the of our museum operations. They're part of the Friends of the Madeline Island Museum, and they were wonderful and generous in helping us expand that ability to tell that story. Yeah, so there was just so many different facets of people and artists and well-wishers, I guess you'd say, even that came together to make this exhibit come to life. And at the end of the day, it was a really humbling process, and we're learning as I interpret and as we share the stories within it to the public. There's always a reciprocity. People are sharing stories and thoughts and information with us too. So we're learning together as this exhibit has been unfolding this summer.
I like how the theme is kind of bringing the legends and the culture to the living, you know, and keeping that conversation going. You mentioned this 500 plus year old dugout canoe on display. There's also a pictograph, which kind of is a visual interpretation of the connection between various clans and their homelands in the area. So could you explain a bit more about this pictograph and its significance?
Yeah, the Oshkabewas pictograph that we light up, originally done on a birch bark scroll, it was transcribed by Eastman for Henry Schoolcraft's book, is a depiction of the chief's delegation journeys to Washington, D.C. The Oshkabewas delegation in 1849, but it's since become a pictograph that's also a synonymous capture of Buffalo's journey. And so we have it in context with the Sandy Lake tragedy and the story of what happened at Sandy Lake. There was a removal order where the Ojibwe were supposed to move out of the Great Lakes region west of the Mississippi. Lured to Sandy Lake, they were denied provisions. On the journey back, over 450 Ojibwe passed away. And after Sandy Lake, the chiefs were in a tough spot. The warriors were very angry and upset. There was talk of war. The chiefs knew that it was time to basically make peace, or things might go in a negative way. So Chief Buffalo journeyed to Washington, and through diplomacy and a really interesting story and series of events, he was able to meet with President Millard Fillmore and have that removal order rescinded. The pictograph ends up carrying a story about Buffalo's journey and the earlier petitions, in that all those, the clan symbols are representative of different chiefs and headmen. In Ojibwe culture, there were clans or dodams that signified family groups. And so those clan symbols are all there, and they all kind of float over this map. And this map has these water bodies that are shown in a couple of lines. And so we explain the clan symbols, and we explain, you know, the heart-mind connectivity and stuff. And then we have a bit of a map decoder. So we use the map decoder to show kind of macro to micro, or you could say micro to macro, on how that pictograph ends up conveying a really, really diverse and amazing view of Anishinaabe earth, Anishinaabe Ojibwe lands and water. All of it centered in wild rice, or this other notion of the place where food grows on the water, their forever home. And it was all or nothing for those old chiefs as they went out there to make peace. And the epilogue is that it's a beautiful day today here in 2024. I'm on the island right now as I speak, and it's a beautiful shared home. It's been a story of peace. And that is that's a beautiful thing. That's what those old chiefs set out to do. So, you know, my staff and I have been really enjoying interacting with folks and sharing, and like I said, in reciprocity, also learning. So I invite everybody to come on up and spend some time. It's definitely well worth the trip.
Well, Mike, I want to thank you so much for joining me today to share more about Passages. And I thank you for the time and all the work that went into it.
Well, thank you, Audrey. It was fun sharing today.
Mike Wiggins Jr. is the site director of the Madeline Island Museum and former executive director and chairman of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. The museum is managed by the Wisconsin Historical Society. And the exhibit, Passages, Ojibwe Migration to the Place Where the Food Grows on Water, is open now through the 2025 season. We'll take one more break, and then WUWM's Susan Bentz investigates why there are so many dragonflies along the lakeshore right now. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Some members of the WUWM team have noticed swarms of dragonflies along the Lake Michigan shoreline in recent weeks. To find out more about why that's happening, we turn to Kate Redmond, an interpretive naturalist and environmental educator. Redmond has been photographing and writing about dragonflies and their relatives, damselflies, for years. WUWM Susan Bentz met Redmond northwest of Milwaukee at the River Edge Nature Center, another place to which dragonflies and damselflies gravitate.
So would you count dragons and damsels as a couple of your favorites in terms of bugs?
Oh, yes. The term Odonata is the name of the order, and the dragonflies and the damselflies are both underneath that umbrella.
There's more than 165 species in Wisconsin. And worldwide, 6,000 plus?
Well, in the country, in North America, there are 325 species of dragonflies and 135 species of damselflies. And of those, 16 species are migratory.
So we're here to talk about dragonflies, but what are the similarities and dissimilarities with damsels and dragons?
Dragonflies tend to be heftier, bulkier. Their eyes are sitting right on the front of their head. When you get a big dragonfly like a common green darner, each one of the compound eyes on the front of its head probably has 25,000 simple eyes in it, just all connected. And they just get like snapshot images from each one of those simple eyes, and their brain processes it and makes it into what they need to know. And when they perch, their wings are straight out to the side, except for a group called the Pennants, and they kind of didn't get the memo, and their wings can be anywhere. And damselflies have slimmer bodies, and they can perch with their wings folded back over their abdomens, and their eyes look like a hammerhead shark. They're way out on the side of the head. Our shortest dragonfly in Wisconsin is just a shade under 1 inch, and our longest damselfly is about 1.5 inches, 3/4 inches, so we can have damsels that are longer than the dragons, but the dragons are bulkier.
So you said, before we press on here, that visual ability tells the dragonfly what it needs to know. What is that?
Most dragonflies and damselflies catch their food, which is other insects, on the wing. And sometimes their food is other dragonflies.
Oh, it is?
Oh, yes.
So is there a time of day that you're more apt to see them, or it's just luck either way?
Well, one of the reasons I like damselflies and dragonflies is that they're very civilized. You don't have to get up at the crack of dawn like you do if you're a birder. And I'm a night person, so crack of dawn is not my time of day. You know, on a day like today, they probably start getting busy around 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning, and that's perfect.
Very civilized.
Perfect, yeah. I photographed a number of damselflies here. Some of them were little guys called eastern forktails that were laying eggs. They grow up in the water, underwater, in a stage called a naiad. When they lay their eggs, they usually lay them into submerged vegetation, so that when the egg hatches, the little guy is popped right out into the water, although there are some that lay their eggs on in the stems above the water, and then when fall and winter come, the stem lays over into the water, and all the different solutions to the same problem. That's what makes nature just really cool, because, you know, everybody has to eat, everybody has to breathe, and there are just so many ways of doing all that.
What months do you see dragonflies?
The first dragonflies we see every year are common green darners that have migrated up from the southeast. They are here usually by late April, beginning of May, and then they mate and lay their eggs in the water and they die. But we also have a resident population of common green darners that emerges a little after the migratory troops have disappeared. So they are around, the ones that are around through the summertime, and about the time that they have mated and laid their eggs and died, then the offspring of the migratory guys are emerging. So that's why we see these huge numbers of common green darners at the end of August, very beginning of September. And this is the crew that's going to go south, and they're not going to come back, but possibly their offspring or their offspring's offspring will come back. So we have dragonflies in the air usually from end of April, depending on the year, through the last of the mosaic darners and the autumn meadowhawks into October.
So who gets to choose these elegant names?
I always wonder about that. There are a couple of groups, the underwing moths and the tiger beetles, that the names are just fabulous. And I think these, you know, entomologists just want to have fun, you know.
But, so how long are these little guys living underwater? It's not just for a season. It can be several years?
For most of them, it's one season. Yeah, the lifespan of any single dragonfly is about a year from egg to adult. And then they spend 9/10 of that underwater, and then they have their flight period, which is for most 6 weeks, 2 months at the most, and then they leave eggs behind and they die. But there are a few species, and especially in colder areas where the naiad stage is 2 years, 3 years, even 4 years, the Heinz Emerald dragonfly, that the really rare one that's found in this area and in Door County, can be 4 or 5 years as a naiad. And that one's kind of bizarre because they love to live in crayfish holes underwater, and crayfish like to eat dragonflies. So how that evolved and why that continues to work out for the dragonfly, I do not know.
So this is a habitat the dragons and damsels can count on, but it's not so across the board.
That is very true, that it's not so across the board. There's one pond that I like to visit that has developed in the last 8 years or so, quite an algae problem. There's just floating mats of algae. And I took a picture 8 or 9 years ago of a female common green darner that was stuck. She had gone down to oviposit on the water, and she had gotten stuck in the algae. And I was able to fish her out. But a really dense algae mat like that changes the whole ball game as far as the amount of oxygen that's available and getting stuck in it, and shading the plants that are growing on the ground, on the floor of the pond. So we're in the process of trying to find out what kind of algae it is and if there's a fix for that, because it used to be just a dynamite place for dragonflies and damselflies, and not so much anymore.
Some people are saying they've seen swarms of dragonflies along Lake Michigan recently. What would account for that?
That would probably be the start of the migratory swarms. There's probably a trickle of the migratory guys going by, and the feeding swarm is usually pretty easy to tell, because they're kind of staying in the same area and just flying around slowly in figure eights looking for food. But one of the most awesome things that I've been able to do is I volunteer at the Hawk Watch at Forest Beach. So I spend a good chunk of September 1st until November 30th on the Hawk Tower. And there's usually 2 or 3 days at the very beginning of September when the sky is literally full of common green darners and saddlebags. There, as I say, there are about 16 species that are migratory. And the main ones we get here are common green darners with some black saddlebags thrown in. And you're standing there on the tower, and they barely even seem to flap their wings. They're just, it's a constant movement from north to south. And you look out with your binoculars to see if there are any hawks coming, and it's common green darners all the way out, as far out as you can see. And there must be hundreds of thousands that go past because they go down the shoreline. That's their roadmap. And it's not coincidental that some of the smaller hawks like kestrels and the merlins, our two smaller falcons, time their, at least the start of their migration with dragonflies, because to some extent their migration is fueled by common green darners.
You're saying they eat them up.
Yes, I have a very out of focus picture of a merlin with a common green darner in its fist, and they'll grab them out of the air with their fist, and they can eat them while they're in flight.
Really?
Yeah. You get up there and you see this, and it's like you're transported back hundreds of thousands of years, because this is something that's been going on for a very long time, and all of a sudden you're just standing there watching this. It's mind blowing.
That was photographer and environmental educator Kate Redmond talking with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. They talked about the dragonflies we're seeing around Milwaukee, and you'll find a link to Redmond's most recent Bug of the Week at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll break down a new Wisconsin Policy Forum report that overviews the state of Milwaukee's K-12 educational ecosystem across all three major sectors: public, charter, and private choice. We'll examine trends in enrollment, student demographics, finances, overall student outcomes, and much more. Join us tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.